In David's notes, he writes, "I would like to mention a man who worked for us named Graham Wilson. Graham answered an advertisement for an assistant dyer. He had just retired at 47 as a chief technician in the Air Force. He was a member of a team responsible for the maintenance of a squadron of aircraft. After a few days, he said, 'No forms, can I design one?' I groaned to Margaret, 'Oh dear, we've got to write one here. Straight out of the services, lots of red tape, I suppose. How are we going to deal with this?' 'I know,' said Margaret. 'Today he asked for help with the colour and I said, put in a pinch of salt.' He said, 'What is a pinch? 5 grams, 3 grams, 10 grams. Graham went on to put in a meticulous record-keeping system for recipes and processing. David concluded, no dye house should ever be without its Graham, and every dyer should be a Graham. Good record-keeping is vital."
Because they were incredibly good dyers and they were very thorough. You know, everything they did, they measured and they weighed and they tested and they did light passness like nobody else. They were absolutely the best at dyeing. Yeah. They were just old-fashioned, generous, sweet people who were doing something they adored and they had a passion for it. Very good madder. Gosh, they were good at madder. And madder's really hard. I could never get that deep red they got.
The Alexander technique is often described as a practice of learning rather than healing. It develops attention rather than force, sensitivity rather than correction, a way of noticing what is already happening. Looking through Margaret and David's archive, I began to see something similar. Their notebooks are full of adjustments, changes to time, temperature, mordants, materials. Small calibrations that made natural processes repeatable, but never identical. What begins to emerge is less a practice of repetition than one of continual testing, a form of making that sits somewhere between craft, chemistry, and experiment. It would be easy to describe them as traditional dyers. In practice, they were constantly asking what natural colour could be made to do and building the tools and methods to find out. The Industrial Revolution transformed dyeing through standardisation. Synthetic dyes succeeded because they removed uncertainty. They produced colour that could be repeated, scaled and sold. Natural dyeing resists that kind of certainty, not because it is imprecise, but because it remains responsive to variation. Margaret and David were working at this point of tension. They were outside the conditions of industrial production, but working within its expectations. Consistency, reliability, repeatability, while still using materials that refuse complete control.
As far as finding new colours and new ways of doing things, very experimental. But when I've been looking at the way that their dye recipes and things, which I was privileged to see occasionally, and particularly indigo, Margaret shared her indigo recipes with me. They were very precise. Partly because David being the scientific side, everything was weighed very accurately. It wasn't just toss something in. It was very much a, you know, what proportion to get this, the proportions of dye matter to yarn, the proportions of mordants to dye matter, all very, very carefully worked through. Margaret was a little less strict, but David was very, very strong on getting things accurate because then it could be repeated. And certainly when they were running the business, they had to be able to repeat colours.
Indigo does not behave like other dyes. In the vat, it is not blue at all, but a deep green, sometimes with a yellow or golden cast as it moves. Cloth is lifted from the dye bath in the liquid state, green, almost luminous, and only becomes blue as it meets the air and oxidizes. The colour is not applied. It appears in relation to the atmosphere itself. There is a kind of theatre in this transformation, but also a precise chemistry, a material state held in suspension until the moment of change. Indigo is not fixed in advance. It completes itself in contact with air. Margaret and David worked with farmers in Pembrokeshire to cultivate both indigo and woad, developing local systems for producing indigotin. At the time, it could not simply be bought, so they built the conditions for making it themselves. There is something of this throughout their practice, a willingness to build what did not already exist, not only in dyes, but in equipment, processes, and ways of working. Machines were modified or designed when nothing suitable could be found. Systems were developed because existing ones were not enough. It was practical work, but also speculative, a way of thinking through making. In this sense, their practice was not only technical, but exploratory. They were not avoiding complexity, but working directly with it, often with a kind of curiosity that bordered on play. Perhaps this is what I learned from them most clearly. Not only how to make colour, but how to build conditions in which colour can happen. Margaret and David's innovation lay here. Not in eliminating unpredictability, but in learning how to work alongside it. A system held lightly, a practice held open.
So David wanted to get a large stainless steel vat to do mass dyeing in. And what was happening at that time was the farms, the dairy farms around us, were just changing from daily to alternate daily collections of the milk. And they were having to upgrade their tanks from moderately sized tanks to big tanks. So the moderately sized tanks were becoming available to buy cheaply. And David and I actually went to a dealer in Letterston and looked at some of these tanks with a view to getting them.
You know, the indigo dyeing is really difficult, and especially if you work from fresh plants and woad. And I think there was a lot of hit and miss work there, and you need to refine your technique. And not even then does it always work. You know, you do everything by the book, and it still doesn't work. And with the indigo dye vats, you know, you sort of take out your, sometimes it's, you know, it works, you get the blue, and then after half an hour it's gone, or so that is, and they were very systematic about that. That is what I learned from them. And I think it's partly from the background of running the mill, you know, that they weren't just hobby dyers. They wanted to produce textiles that, that's what their life was about, producing textiles that would be used and that would be beautiful. So David was very interested in doing things so that the textiles would actually, you know, the colors would last. And he tried, you know, he worked hard on making that happen.
I would like to think that a lot of their knowledge has fed into the story of natural dyes. How they stayed true to their principles. And the poem that often comes to mind with them is one by Edward Lear, The Jumblies. You know, they went to sea in a sieve, they did, in a sieve they went to sea. Because they, you know, they had this belief and they would stay with it despite everyone going, that's not a very good idea, that's not very sensible. You know, they were there for each other and life was an adventure. And to be lived.
You can take a pause now or continue to the next chapter titled All One.